Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the ICU Ed and Toddcast, ICU Ed Like Education, Ed and Todd, Toddcast Podcast. I am Eddie. He is Todd. And today we're so excited to have two super special guests, Eddie Fan and Whitney Gannon.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone.
Today we're going to be talking about vent avoid, which is extracorporeal carbon dioxide removal to avoid invasive ventilation during exacerbations of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. No big programming notes before we begin. Just to mention that, please, if you enjoyed the podcast, then like, subscribe, leave a 5-star review, tell your friend. This is how the podcast search algorithms recommend podcasts to other people.
Tell your friend.
For me, it's a friend. For you all, tell your friends. Whitney, hello again. You were on with us about a year ago talking about Inception, which was ECPR for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Thank you so much for agreeing to come back on with us, proving that we're not super scary. The last time we talked about your beekeeper mentor named Buzz. How is the beekeeping life and how is life in general since we last had you on?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I'm very honored to be back on here. I absolutely love your podcast and I listen to it every time you have a new release. I would say that my beekeeping career is not particularly blossoming, especially since we last spoke, but I'm still trying and we're about to start a new season. So hopefully things will get a little better for us.
No, she undersells it a little bit, Eddie. I think we've seen some of the honey that she's provided to us, her colleagues. So there's at least some output.
Just a little output.
Whether it's as much
just
as
enough to keep me trying.
Right.
Eddie, first of all, I'm very used to not being the smartest person on this podcast, but now I'm not even the smartest Eddie on this podcast. So I'll have to get used to that. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast with us.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to help you out with that. Easier to make you the smartest Eddie on this podcast, no problem.
Oh, that's not true. I have some questions for you just to let everybody get a chance to know you. But first, I guess, Todd, how are you?
I'm great. You told me last time I can't talk about the weather, so I'll talk about, trying to meet deadlines and get some work done. And
I think you should go back to talking about the weather. It's a lot more exciting than meeting deadlines. Todd once told me that he feels bad for sending people his CV because it's so long. I think that's the definition of a humble brag. But Eddie, you got Todd beat, at least in citations on PubMed. If I could pull out some common themes, I see a lot of ARDS and ECMO, including being a part of many consensus definition and management guidelines and landmark trials like EOLIA. In fact, you have a publication from 2017 in Intensive Care Medicine where the conclusion was ECOR is currently an experimental technique rather than accepted therapeutic strategy, and its safety and efficacy require confirmation in clinical trials. So it seems like you were both ahead of the curve and someone listened to you. We'll get into this and obviously the details of vent avoid, but first, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and a hobby that people that work with you may not know about you?
Yeah, sure. So, maybe to start off, thanks for inviting me to the podcast. Really excited to be here. I don't have much to tell you to put your listeners to sleep, but I'm an adult intensivist from Toronto, born and raised here in Canada. Hobbies, I guess one of my favorite things to do, which is probably strange, is I love watching bad horror movies. Any sort of B horror movies or whatever it comes out, I see it. Zombies, ghosts, exorcisms, that's my thing. I like watching them, especially on long plane flights. And reading books. I think that those are maybe some hobbies that I like to do in my spare time.
I can't tell you that I would necessarily tick you up on a recommendation, but what was the most recent horror movie you watched?
I watched the new Exorcist that had just come out on, which was unfortunately a pale comparison to the original.
I'll take your word for it. And if anyone asks me for that, that's what I'm going to tell them because I can't do that, especially not on a plane.
I don't know why I love them, but I just love them.
I already referenced your wide range of clinical and academic interests, including ECMO. What got you so interested in ECMO and studying ECMO?
I think at the time it was something that to me seemed pretty new. I saw maybe a handful of cases of ECMO when I was a fellow. And invariably, these patients all unfortunately did very poorly. They typically came out of the operating room with like a team of 20, sometimes on ECMO, sometimes on cardiopulmonary bypass. And, just got me thinking that maybe there would be a better way for some of these patients to be treated. My main interest at the time was in, respiratory failure, ARDS. And a lot of my mentors were working in that area. And just thinking about the next logical way to support these patients, ECMO was just sort of something that not many people were thinking about. So that's how I got interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was your interest and your entrance into the field. I know that you and Whitney together are both very busy submitting grants for future research. So thank you again, both for taking your time out of busy schedules to be here with us. But to you, Eddie, what are some of the unanswered questions in ECMO, or asked in a different way? In 5 to 10 years, where do you hope ECMO management and ECMO is as a field?
You know, there's so many parts of the management of ECMO patients that we just don't have a good handle on yet. So things like, how do I anticoagulate these patients? How best to ventilate them? What's the right sedation strategy? How safe is it to mobilize them? Like sort of all the daily aspects of management of the patients that we could better optimize. And maybe that would reduce complications and improve outcomes in patients who are supported by ECMO. I mean, in reality, we need to answer some of these questions just in critically ill patients in general, but similarly in this field. And I think, you know, in 5 to 10 years, it'd be great to have some answers to some of those questions, because again, I think that learning how to better manage these patients might help us to lead to better outcomes.
As we're talking about just before we hopped on recording, that you never know kind of what's coming next that's going to give us a new windfall of patients who need to be on ECMO. I mean, there's a lot of hurdles to research, and ECMO research especially. What do you think are some of the biggest hurdles to getting to that point in 5 to 10 years? And Whitney, Todd, and also welcome to chime in here.
Yeah, I think one of the hurdles, which I think we're actually working on getting past, is exactly sort of on this podcast, is that, you know, there are not a lot of ECMO patients at any one center. So to do this kind of research, we need to look to multi-center collaboration, and both national and international collaboration. And again, it's been a pleasure to work with Whitney on some of the answers to these questions. And that's just an example of us trying to collaborate and coordinate around the world to come up with the best strategies to answer these questions in the, you know, most timely, efficient, and resource-effective manner. I think that's been a big hurdle. But I think, again, we've been working hard to cross international borders to help make that happen.
Eddie, I think that the population of patients that we treat with ECMO is smaller than many of the other conditions that we study. And so numbers are always a problem with ECMO. And then I think the second part that we have to be really, really thoughtful about is that, just like early on with ventilation trials, we would always assess the control arm and say, you know, how good was the ventilation in the control arm? Trying to understand how good people's ECMO care is really hard. And I think I at least know from a personal learning curve, there's a really steep learning curve. And the more you do, the better you are at it. But it's hard to do more because we don't do a ton of cases, especially if you're not at a big academic referral center. And so to get experienced ECMO people who are good at it, who you can then use as investigators into studies, I think is a challenge. And I think it's a challenge that we're going to face for a few years, at least going forward.
Kind of going off of that, on the other side of it, you know, at these large academic centers, there's a lot of equipoise. And I think, you know, that can contribute to the challenge of studying these questions and, you know, as well.
Yeah, and we can also take advantage of the equipoise, right? So if people are doing it different ways, then it seems like that's a good question to study. So that's all great. Todd, do you have anything else to say before we jump in?
I don't think so. I think I haven't said this, but I'm excited that both Eddie Fan, not you, Eddie, you're always here, Eddie Fan and Whitney have joined us. And I think this is a great article to discuss, because I think it's going to bring up a lot of discussion beyond just the results of the trial.
So we're going to go ahead and jump in like we normally do. Whitney, I think we started doing this after you were last on, but we start actually each trial by grading the trial acronym. It's just a simple scale from 0 to 10, bigger numbers, meaning you like it more. Spoiler alert, this one is as hard. The full official title of this project was Extracorporeal CO2 Removal with Hemolung RAS for Mechanical Ventilation Avoidance During Acute Exacerbation of COPD. So I have to imagine that Vent Avoid is not truly an acronym. It came from ventilation and avoidance. Todd, what are your thoughts here? I can say that I'm not super thrilled.
Yeah, I actually love the acronym. Right? I mean, it describes the trial and I like it from that standpoint. The downgrade that I have is that, and maybe I could sit there and look at the title, because the title is long enough, you can probably come up with the right letters to get to the actual acronym, but it's not intuitive where the letters come from to get to the acronym.
Yeah, that's fair. Whitney, Eddie, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree. I think like the name is great because it's sort of catchy and encapsulates what the sort of main thrust of the trial is, but how it links to the actual full name of the trial is kind of cheating, I guess, in that way.
I agree. And I'm really interested to know where you put the weight in your rating.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you're going to skip a whole bunch of words, you could have done like E-core COPD or something along those lines. Vendavoid doesn't tell me what the intervention is at all. Todd complained because he didn't get to grade first. And so I'll go ahead first this time. I think I'm a 4 out of 10 here. It's not super descriptive. It's not really an acronym. I get where it's coming from, but I think I'm slightly below average. I think it was, and maybe a little bit ambitious of a title per se.
You've gone back to being a harder grader than I am. I think I'm probably in the 5.5 or 6 realm on this, only because I think because as you get older, you can't remember things. And like Ventavoid is something I'm going to be able to remember. So even though it just mashes up all the letters and makes that part hard, honestly, I don't have to remember the long full title of the trial. So I'm at 5.5 or 6.
Yeah, I mean, I have the whole title right in front of me reading. I can't remember all of that. Whitney, Eddie, what grades are you going to give this?
Yeah, I think I'm on your page. I think I'm still learning how to grade. Actually, I find this very challenging.
I think I'm a 5.
5. I'm going to split the difference a little bit there. Whitney, you didn't give us a number.
All right, I'll say 6.
6. All right. Perfect. I think that fits our personalities pretty well.
Because the listeners probably don't know this. Whitney's scale actually goes from 7 to 10 because she's so nice. She won't give anybody anything below 7. So
that's true. I mean, it's kind of true.
You have to stay optimistic in this business.
You know? Most of our listeners probably already know about ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Taking the blood out of the body through an oxygenator that facilitates gas exchange and putting it back into the body. What do I need to know about E-core here?
I would say, you know, E-core is one of the extracorporeal life support platforms, I would say, and similar to ECMO, but different in that it is not providing oxygenation in general. You have, you know, a membrane and gas exchanger, but you're using smaller cannula sizes, you're using lower flows. And therefore, you're facilitating CO2 removal, but you're not providing the oxygen exchange that you would in your typical ECMO circuits that you're probably thinking of.
Whitney, you've always taught me that CO2 removal is more efficient and easier to do than oxygenation. And so this is, and that I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's the reason you get away with smaller cannulas, lower flows, is because the efficiency is higher. And so you can actually remove CO2.
Yeah.
More easily than you can provide oxygen.
Yeah, absolutely. Takes a very small amount of, you know, sweet gas flow sometimes to have a pretty considerable effect on your CO2 removal.
I think, Eddie, it's one of your manuscripts that describes that we can potentially even be too efficient at removing CO2 when we not in COPD patients. So we're not talking about the avoid vent trial, but in our ARDS patients, for example, when we put them on, we often get such robust removal of CO2 that there's some worry about could that result in some neurologic changes. And you know, it's one of the things, at least in our practice, that we watch pretty closely and make sure we don't drop the CO2 too fast.
Yeah, it's because of that data that when we initiate ECMO, we start lower actually now.
Yeah, that's something that we noticed, an association between how quickly the CO2 can be corrected, which again can be quite fast when you're starting extracorporeal support. And that seems to be linked to neurologic complications like stroke and bleeding. And so similarly in our program, whatever the configuration we're starting, we typically start at a very low sweet gas of 1, unless there's some compelling reason to remove CO2 faster, just to avoid these rapid shifts in the first 12 to 24 hours.
Those of us who have more experience with ECMO than E-core, you say smaller cannulas and lower flows. When I think about ECMO cannulas, I think about somewhere in the like 20 French-ish range for the cannula sizes. And then I'm thinking about flows in like the 3 to 5 liters per minute, not counting extreme cases. What kind of sizes and flows are we talking about here?
The Hemolung is 15 French cannula, I believe. And, you know, you kind of insert it similar to it's really a very small cannula, really, but, you know, it doesn't go as deep. So you use a similar technique as like a vas cath. And then flows of, I believe, 300 to 500 or 300 to a liter or so. Eddie may know better.
Yeah, so they like to differentiate by calling it a catheter rather than a cannula. So it's, again, it's a 15.5 French catheter, much like
names matter.
Yeah, and at least this device, the Hemolung device, had a flow up to 550 mils per minute, so somewhere in the 350 to 550 range to remove CO2.
Oh wow, that's really low. I didn't realize that. Thanks for clarifying that.
And a little different, but you know, for me, the concept appears to be more similar to dialysis than it does to the like full on ECMO. You know, those are flows that are a little higher than we get in dialysis, but not that much higher than we get in dialysis. And the catheter is a little bit bigger, but not really bigger than what we're doing in dialysis. Obviously the membrane's different and the purpose is different. But I think when I think of it, I think of more in that renal replacement therapy than I think of like our bigger, higher flow ECMO.
You'll hear it termed respiratory dialysis sometimes, to your point.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Eddie, as Todd has referenced already, you've written about ECOR in the past prior to Ventavoid. What was the state of the evidence for use of ECOR, both in general and in COPD, kind of before this?
Yeah, I would say the evidence for this trial was mainly observational data, lots of it single center observational data, reporting on the experience of a center, again, deploying CO2 removal, again, for this situation, acute exacerbations of COPD, or in some cases to use in maybe ARDS patients to help to reduce the intensity of mechanical ventilation. But a lot of observational data, not many clinical trials examining it in a more rigorous way. But I think amongst the indications that CO2 removal was being considered for, this one kind of makes the most sense, right? And here, maybe we could grade the naming of the device. The device includes the name CO2 removal. The main issue here in the population of study is hypercapnic respiratory failure. So there's kind of a direct line of sight, right, between what we think the device is going to do, which is remove CO2, and the main problem, which is too much CO2. So, you know, I would say that, you know, from the available data, this seemed to make the most sense, right? Because, you know, sort of is directly related to the problem that we're talking about. And again, I would say that most of the observational data, again, being single center cohort studies, case series, this sort of thing, suggested that there were benefits to the use of this kind of a device in these acute exacerbations of COPD, whether that led to avoiding the need for invasive mechanical ventilation in patients failing non-invasive ventilation, or facilitating earlier liberation from mechanical ventilation and perhaps earlier mobilization in patients that were already sick and got intubated with their exacerbation. So, you know, the premise of this trial at least seemed to be supported by the available data at the time.
Todd, Whitney, you have anything to add there?
I was just going to say that, you know, oftentimes I say, wait, can somebody explain this to me? Walk me through this. This was not a concept that I needed somebody to explain it to me. As Eddie kind of started with, it's pretty intuitive. Right? This is a device that removes CO2. It's in the name of the device. And we have a disease where the main problem appears to be accumulation of too much CO2. And you would think that this would be a marriage made in heaven and that this should be a reasonable use for such a device.
Yeah. And if we're talking about the names, I mean, I've seen the ECOR have the little subscript 2 for the CO2 there. And I mean, it's a beautiful name.
10 out of 10.
I'm giving it a 6.
You're going to get a 6? You're giving me a 6. Whitney gives it a 10 out of 10. I'm closer to Whitney on that one, Todd. Nobody in our institution, I don't think, has gotten ECOR. At least I've not seen it. We have patients who got ECMO and end up having more ventilatory problems and requiring primary sweep as they progress through their ECMO courses. Do you feel like people have been excited about ECOR, kind of chomping at the bit to do this? Or do you think people in general have approached this with a little bit more caution?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start by saying, I think people were excited for a number of reasons. I think one is, as Whitney sort of alluded to, this was something that seemed, and Todd also mentioned, it's more in line with renal replacement therapy than it is with full-out ECMO. So the idea that if this was going to be efficacious, it might have more widespread application than, say, ECMO, due to lower complexity and maybe simpler use. Maybe it's more akin to technology that's already being used in many ICUs around the world, sort of similar to that kind of platform. So there was excitement from that point of view. And again, like I would say, the data sort of suggested that perhaps this was a method of supporting some of these patients with COPD exacerbations that might lead to better patient tolerance, right? They could be more awake. They wouldn't need intubation or a tight-fitting mask. They could keep eating, communicating with their family, with their caregivers, with the clinical team. Perhaps it might lead to benefits like more less sedation, more ability to mobilize and not be having enforced bed rest in the ICU. So again, it seemed like there were a lot of potential benefits to this intervention. So I think people were pretty excited about the prospect of what this trial might show.
The only thing I'd add, Eddie, is that adding on to Eddie's potential benefits is, I think we all think if we can avoid intubating in somebody, mechanically ventilating somebody, that, you know, that has to be a win, right? We can't envision how that wouldn't be a win. And we'll talk about this, but, you know, that as a potential outcome to prove that this would be beneficial, I think would be the home run. It would be the the panacea if you could say, you know, hey, you don't have to intubate patients that come in with hypercarbic respiratory failure from COPD because you can do this respiratory dialysis. I think there would be lots and lots and lots of excitement about demonstrating that that's the case.
And it did seem, you know, and I remember when there was first kind of discussion around this, and there was a lot of excitement and momentum, and it did seem like, oh, maybe this would be, there was some, you know, without really knowing, there was some thought about, you know, this being a higher, kind of a better safety profile, smaller cannulas, you know, a lower invasive technology to help patients. And so, you know, I recall a lot of enthusiasm around that. And just from our clinical observations, it seemed like it was doing these things, meeting those physiologic goals and things like that.
So let's jump in and talk a little bit about the study. Venovoid was a multi-center prospective randomized control trial done, I think, in the United States. It was investigator-led and designed, but it was notably funded by A-Lung Technologies, which manufactures the Hemolung device. Patients were those with documented diagnoses of COPD or asthma COPD overlap and experiencing a COPD exacerbation. There were two stratum that they used to enroll patients. They had a non-invasive strata and then an intubated strata. The intubated strata is easier, and it's just if they were intubated for a COPD exacerbation for 5 days or less and they're failing an SBT, or if they're not eligible yet for an SBT, then they'd be eligible to be enrolled in the study. So not the avoiding intubation, but trying to get someone off the breathing tube sooner. Non-invasive ventilation strata, there was a number of criteria, which if I had to summarize it, it was worsening or non-improving hypercarbia on non-invasive ventilation. Or I think what they were trying to get at is when you might think about intubating a patient for their COPD exacerbation. A little bit more specifically and with some numbers, you could get in if you had a severe acidosis defined by an arterial pH of less than or equal to 7.25 and couldn't tolerate non-invasive ventilation, or you had a clinical decompensation like a mental status decline. Otherwise, they said if you're on non-invasive ventilation for an hour with a worsening or non-improving severe acidosis, tachypnea up to 30, or your CO2 was worsening, then you could get into the trial and be eligible for this intervention. Any thoughts on this inclusion criteria? I think the question is, did it enroll the patients that you wanted to see in the study?
Eddie, they used the term failing NIV as the inclusion criteria. And when I read that, I was like, oh, failing NIV. And then I read their criteria. And I have to admit, when I read their criteria, I go, yeah, those are people in clinical times. I think this person's probably failing NIV. And they're people that I think, do I need to intubate that patient? And then obviously there's some other factors that come into play. So I actually thought it was probably the right population. But when we get to the results and we talk about it, we may revisit that and say, was this really the right population?
Yeah, no, Eddie, Whitney, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I think obviously retrospectively now, we might look back and think slightly differently. But I agree, like a lot of these criteria, you might, you know, in clinical practice, think that would trigger at least a conversation or some thinking about whether these patients should be intubated and are truly failing NIV. I guess my question, and again, we don't have as granular a breakdown in terms of how they were enrolled or the reasons, but certainly some of the components are somewhat subjective, right? In terms of there, you could even get in if the dyspnea was worsening on non-invasive ventilation, you know, what really constituted a change or decrease in level of consciousness, intolerance, like some of these were clinician sort of assessments of failure. Again, like clinically, that's how we might assess failure, but at least from a trial standpoint, might have allowed some subjectivity. And again, depending on your eagerness, perhaps, to approach these patients for enrollment in the trial, there might have been some flexibility around some of these criteria.
I think the thing that stuck out to me the most about the inclusion criteria, and I may be wrong about this, but you know, it says after at least 1 hour of non-invasive due to one or more of the following, and then listed all those things that I agree would make you think about intubation. But it's interesting, like, to think about some of this stuff standalone, like a pH of less than or equal to 7.25, that's not very meaningful without also having a respiratory rate or also having some sort of setting on your, you know, non-invasive machine. And so that was kind of interesting to me. I felt like it was a little bit different than Eolia in terms of these criteria as a constellation of optimization. These felt a little standalone.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. This is what you would teach people, right? This is when you say, okay, your patient on non-invasive ventilation for hypercarbic respiratory failure is failing. You should think about intubation. And I don't think you can ding the authors at all for the inclusion criteria that they had. But I think, and Todd's going to say that because I know the results, I say this, but I think the key there is it's not that you automatically intubate the patient when they hit that criteria, it's that you think about it. And so I think a lot of these times I'll be trying to optimize my non-invasive ventilation and I'll look at that and say, is there something else I can do on non-invasive ventilation first?
But I will say, Eddie, the classic teaching, and maybe this is just because I'm old and I'm still stuck in classic teaching, but classic teaching, as I was taught and as I teach, and that's probably why you said it, because I was your mentor and I gave you this misinformation. But
classic teaching
is that if you're not better after an hour of non-invasive ventilation, that's probably not a successful non-invasive ventilation and you should rethink what you're doing. And so, you know, I think their criteria say we were looking for people who weren't better after an hour of non-invasive ventilation. And as we'll get to, I think near the end of this, maybe some of what we get from this is that we need to rethink our teaching. But
yeah, I mean, that's why I say you can't really ding them, because this is exactly what we teach people. The intervention here was standard of care versus standard of care with ECOR. I don't have too many more comments there. I think that's pretty straightforward. The primary outcome was ventilator-free days and 5 days after randomization where death was penalized by a value of -1. That's a pretty short follow-up window. I think it's not unreasonable given the presumed course of a COPD exacerbation, but you could imagine some bias in an unblinded trial where you could potentially extubate on ECOR. What did you guys think about that outcome?
Yeah, it's pretty short. And I think they tried to explain it by saying like the mechanism by which they thought their intervention was going to have an effect was, again, either to prevent the need for intubation, which is a pretty acute event after initiating non-invasive ventilation, or again, facilitating earlier liberation from invasive mechanical ventilation. I think it's interesting, though, that their original primary outcome was a much longer primary outcome of ventilator-free days to day 60. Again, because these patients are somewhat dynamic. And as you said, there could be rapid physiologic improvement that could, in an unblinded trial, lead to earlier changes in the support strategy. But it would be important to know if these patients then subsequently deteriorated because there was too early liberation or not rapid enough intubation, say, for the different strata. But clearly, they actually modified their primary outcome a number of times in this trial, as documented on clinicaltrials.gov, to shorter and shorter time windows for their primary outcome.
Yeah, and I couldn't find anything, and maybe it's there and I just couldn't find in the supplement, about like protocolized decannulation or decatheterization in this case versus extubation. What came first? Was it all up to the clinician? So, I mean, if they had some part of that protocol, that would kind of eschew some of my concerns there. I think the other thing to mention in the method section is, well, this trial was stopped early because of slow enrollment, and so it is ultimately underpowered for what they planned for. Figure one actually demonstrates that, just segueing into the results. They screened almost 6,000 patients and they randomized 113 patients. Half of them screened out because they weren't failing non-invasive ventilation, which is ultimately a good thing. Another quarter didn't give consent or had a do not intubate order. And there was a smattering of other reasons, which all seemed reasonable. Table one and two are baseline characteristics. The median age was 63. It was mostly female at 66%. The median BMI was 28. The GCS was 11. pH was 7.35 and PCO2 was 65. So I think globally, considering the overall low numbers in each of the groups, so both the intervention and control for both the non-invasive and intubated strata, I think the groups were fairly balanced overall. Todd, I don't know if you have anything else that you want to comment on here. I thought that the supplemental table E2 showing the median number of COPD exacerbations in the past year for these patients as 2, I was pretty telling that it's a pretty sick population they enrolled.
Yeah, I think the baseline characteristics say that they're fairly acutely ill also. There's some differences between the groups, especially when you go into the strata that have 25 or 35 patients in them, but that's not that surprising. That happens when you have smaller numbers in a group. It's not anything that, at least to me, raised any huge red flags.
Any red flags from either of you, Whitney, Eddie? I see some shaking, which we can't communicate over a podcast, so I'll just say that aloud.
Let me ask a question of Eddie and Whitney.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Todd.
I think I know the answer to this, but I'd love their take too. One of the things you could ding the authors for, the investigators for, in this is if you thought they did bad ECOR, like their process wasn't right, you know, they didn't use it right or something like that. I don't get that impression, but I want to make sure when I have people on that are better at assessing that than I am, that I'm not missing a potential reason that, you know, I should be thinking of their outcomes differently because somebody says, well, they just didn't know what they were doing.
Well, I would definitely be more interested in what Eddie's thoughts are, but I would say a couple of things. It was actually hard. I don't know if I just missed it, but it was a little hard for me to find in Ventavoid, and it was hard for me to find in the rest trial, but I would be interested in knowing a little bit more about how, you know, these patients were managed, like especially around anticoagulation. And I think in theory, you know, eCor, this hemolung device is, it seems as though it would be a more simple device than ECMO, but it's, you know, it is different. And I do wonder about cannulation. And given the fact that, you know, so many centers were involved in these trials, like 30, 40 centers enrolling, you know, most of them a handful of patients over 5 years, who's doing these procedures? Because, like, you know, you do see a fair number of complications and things. And so I think there is I think it's fair to say that there could be variation in the way that eCor is delivered.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, although it's touted as a simpler support strategy or device than full-blown ECMO, like it still has a learning curve, something new. And maybe I could just disclose that this device was actually Health Canada approved prior to the pandemic. So we had been using it, you know, for a number of years, and we certainly had a learning curve even in, we're an ECMO center, but the cannulation is, or the catheterization is different. The kits to insert are different. They were actually quite tricky. They've been evolved over time to try to simplify things. But again, we'll probably get into discussion that might have led to some complications or more propensity to complications, especially in trying to build experience. And if you're only putting like each center one or two patients on, then any training or education you might have around that could be challenging. And agreed. And, you know, it's interesting, and maybe we'll get into this conversation close to the end, but as much as these systems are touted to be safer, in fact, you probably actually need more anticoagulation in some of these systems, right? Like, I mean, one of the advantages perhaps of running ECMO at higher flow is that the propensity to have thrombotic complications could be lower. But if you're running relatively low flow, you might actually need more anticoagulation to prevent problems. And that might lead to more complications as well.
Yeah, so we've been dancing around those adverse events. So I think let's talk about those outcomes really quickly, and then jump a little bit more into those adverse events. That's what found in Table 3. For patients who are at risk of failing non-invasive, there was no difference between the groups. The median upper and lower bounds of the confidence intervals for the outcome of ventilator-free days to 5 days was 5, which just means that by and large, those patients didn't get intubated either in the standard of care or the eCor group. I think this is what we were talking about before, where we're saying that when you have this patient who meets this criteria, maybe the first thing that we're thinking about is, can I still stave off intubation by doing something with our non-invasive? For the patients who were already intubated, there was a numerical increase in ventilator-free days. With eCor, it was 2 compared to 0.25 days. The trial was underpowered potentially, and the p-value here is 0.21. Before we talk a lot more about the adverse events, what did you guys think about this outcome? Or are there any secondary outcomes that you'd like to highlight there from Table 3?
I mean, I think there are some very, very intriguing outcomes. One is that essentially these patients who we thought were failing NIV didn't get intubated, right? That's the first thing that jumped out to me, is I was like, wait, you know, at least my teaching was these patients, we should think about intubating them. And in the standard of care arm, we didn't intubate them.
I'm not surprised that the things you taught me ended up being wrong, Todd. I've gotten used to that over the years.
And the other part of that is that you could say, well, you didn't intubate them, but they all died. They didn't die either. So it's not like we didn't intubate them and they died. They didn't have either of those outcomes. And while I thought that might be the biggest benefit of using eCor in these patients, you can't prevent intubation if you don't intubate the patients, right? And so that was the first thing that jumped out at me. It was like, wow. And it made me, as you guys could probably tell, rethink this whole thing where I'm like, man, I'm telling house staff, if you're not better after an hour, we should think about doing something else. And this says, if you're not better after an hour, you should keep going, and, you know, they might be okay.
Well, I think that teaching is right, though, is you should think about doing something else, but doesn't mean necessarily you should do something else,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, this trial says you shouldn't think about putting in any extracorporeal cannula right now, or catheter right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I do wonder if they had tweaked it to the clinician is getting ready to intubate someone for their COPD exacerbation, hypercarbia. And so the one group was going to get intubated, but that would be more the patient population we were looking for here. I don't know what, Whitney, Eddie, what you guys think there.
So they enrolled 100 out of 6,000 screened patients, and you want to make it even harder for them to enroll, Eddie. That's perfect.
I'm looking for 100 patients in 10 years.
Methodology. Clearly, I taught you great clinical trial methodology.
I mean, taught me great COPD management too. So thanks for that.
Whitney and I can leave the podcast if you guys need more time yourselves to sort of battle out.
We need you here to be between us like parents. That's why we invite guests.
Petulant children on this podcast.
But I agree. I think that's maybe the wasn't the primary focus of the trial, but I think sort of teaches us, you know, as usual, we should be humble in that running clinical trials is difficult. And the population we thought would be at risk and therefore the population that we should put under study because we feel that they could benefit from the intervention as per our clinical data to the point and what, sort of our rationale for the mechanism of action, like these aren't the right patients. I think, you know, to Todd's point, like we think these are the sick patients, but again, I think maybe, and again, it's just going to make it even more difficult for a future trial, but we probably need a better way to identify patients at high risk because of course the device itself has some fixed risks, which I think we're going to talk about. And therefore, we really need to be better at identifying those patients who are at risk, at the highest risk of poor outcomes, so that perhaps the risk-benefit ratio in that group of COPD patients would be where this kind of a device could operate.
Yeah, it's hard to win the risk-benefit ratio when your benefit is near zero.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit about the adverse events, so let's go ahead and jump into that. That's table five. Table four was physiologic parameters, which I'll just go ahead and skip for unless someone wants to bring up something from there.
Yeah, let me say this, because I think Whitney will laugh about this. The one thing I think is missing from table four is serum bicarbs. And what we've learned, not with ECOR, right, but with ECMO in COVID, is that the serum bicarb matters a lot. And, you know, one of our colleagues, Ren Atkinson, actually has a publication that kind of shows that the serum bicarb may matter in ECMO more than we, or at least our group, initially thought. So they give us a pH, they give us respiratory physiology parameters. But I would have loved to have asked, you know, what is the serum bicarb and maybe what happens to the serum bicarb over the course of the couple of days that we're doing this. I don't think the device changes your serum bicarb. But certainly if you've lowered the PCO2 and raised the pH, a functioning kidney may waste off some of your bicarb that you've accumulated. And then you may have attenuated some of your potential benefit from CO2 removal.
Yeah, I mean, one of the lowest bars to clear in this world is to make Whitney laugh. And I didn't see a crack a smile there. Oh, there it is. I got the laugh. Whitney, what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised that Todd wants to see the bicarb. No, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, I think that's a good point, and I think that's true, and I think could potentially be higher in some of these patients if they have chronic component, and you know, I think it could potentially matter, like you're saying.
Yeah, so that's all I wanted to say about table four, Eddie.
Oh, no, absolutely. Adverse events. There are a lot of complications from ECOR. I think that's the takeaway. About 43% of the patients randomized to ECOR had at least a non-serious adverse event related to ECOR. 39% had a serious adverse event. Looking at the breakdown, it was almost all bleeding. Cannulation site bleeding, well, hemolysis, thrombocytopenia, cannula site oozing. Whitney, I think we've already alluded to this. This is a topic near and dear to your heart. What do you think when you kind of see this table?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that we've learned through our experience and data, and there's actually a recent paper from also the ELSO registry, bleeding really matters. We do see bleeding events, we do see thrombotic events, but it really seems as though bleeding is what affects mortality in a different way and in a more meaningful way. And I think we really need to focus on how to minimize bleeding.
Yeah, Eddie, you had mentioned that you have experience with these kits and these cannulations. In their supplemental table E8 gives some descriptions. There's RP bleeds, but there's hemodynamic instability during cannulation requiring massive transfusion. There's a hemothorax during following cannulation. Now, I understand that these things can happen, but when you see that, are you surprised? Are you not surprised? So for me, I was a little bit surprised there.
Yeah, I think, and this, again, I think mirrors our initial experience when we first had Hemolung in Canada, like some of the challenges with actually, despite the fact that the catheter is smaller, it's more like a dialysis catheter, that there are challenges to inserting this catheter. And I think you see that here. And again, with a good number of cannulation-related bleeding, which is challenging, I think we also had a similar experience that thrombocytopenia seems a bit more common with this device than maybe other extracorporeal support devices. And there's thrombocytopenia reported here. But I think maybe the concerning thing is that amongst the ECOR related deaths, like three of the four of them were associated with bleeding, right? To Whitney's point, right? So I think, and maybe that speaks again back to our comment from our prior comment about the user experience, right? Like in terms of these sites were all naive or relatively naive to the use of this device. It's a trial device that was brought in education. So the experience with the device was limited. And if some of these centers were enrolling only one or two patients, they really didn't have, you know, really a substantial experience with using the insertion kits or running the device. So, and that may have all contributed to some of these complications.
I don't know this answer. And I know that Eddie Chen doesn't know this answer either, but does anybody know the complication rates similar of bleeding and catheter-associated bleeding with actual dialysis, with actual kidney replacement therapy? We talk about these catheters are similar to that, you know, the flows are similar to that and that sort of stuff. I would have thought that they would have been less than what we see with ECMO. This suggests that maybe they're not. And now I'm just wondering if I'm just oblivious to these sorts of complications, even from my extracorporeal dialysis for kidney failure patients. And I just don't have that in my brain as a fairly high incidence of complications.
I don't know, Todd, like you said, but I feel like we do VAS caths for dialysis access all the time. And I feel like if someone died from a VAS cath access, we would be talking about that in our morbidity and mortality conferences. So I think it's fairly low. The question I was going to ask, and while I was making faces, was that how do these outcomes compare to ECMO? Right. So just normal ECMO, is this more 40% is more than we would see by the way they define their adverse events, or less, or is it kind of on par?
Well, Whitney probably knows this literature better than I'm sure she knows this literature better than I do. But I think, you know, at least from recent data, I think Whitney was talking about before, especially from the COVID experience, bleeding is certainly more common than thrombotic complications and they're more important. So I think, again, but you sort of the degree of bleeding and where the bleeding is coming from is probably important. But my sense is that the numeric value or sort of the proportion of patients who had some bleeding is probably not too different than VV ECMO patients. It's just the severity and maybe type of bleeding. So, you know, having some oozing at the cannula site or minor bleeding, that's pretty common and that would be classified as bleeding. I think in a recent, again, European publication, again, focused on COVID, bleeding was occurring in maybe 45% of patients who were on VV ECMO for COVID. And so that's sort of the same ballpark as this. But again, maybe what's surprising about these data are why the bleeding is occurring, like related to catheterization and the severity of the bleeding, which is probably a bit, I would say, out of keeping with our experience from VV ECMO.
I love how Eddie acts like he doesn't know the data and then just crushes the data, right? It's the exact number. It's about, 45.5%. But I think that, and I just looked it up. That's why I know this. That is the number that is in many studies, is that it's about 45% bleeding adverse event rates for ECMO. So
we saw a similar rate even in Eolia and other, you know, large studies. I think the question is, in those studies and somewhere like Eolia and the ECMO studies, like the ends sort of are justifying the means because those patients are appearing to experience a larger benefit than they do risk. And so, you know, I think the bleeding events in these ECOR trials, I feel like, are highlighted because they're a little bit unexpected. I don't think people would have expected so many complications. And I know, you know, particularly in the REST trial, you know, having a high rate of intracranial hemorrhaging was extremely serious. And so, you know, that really casted a light on these bleeds. And I think the risk benefit may be different in, you know, the other populations that we're using ECMO for. And the bleeding may not be so different exactly.
Yeah, they made a comment on the intracerebral hemorrhages in REST and then how they didn't really see that here. But I mean, they saw plenty of other bleeding. So bleeding that causes death, I think, is bleeding that causes death no matter where it is. Whitney and Eddie, you both are very involved in research that can improve the way that we care for our patients receiving extracorporeal life support, which in theory could decrease these complications and change this risk-benefit equation that we're talking about. Once you two have solved the world's problems, do you think that we need to come back to some of these negative trials and say, well, that was then, but now I'll be different? You know, I think in ECMO in general, and then also specifically for ECOR.
Well, I do think that's a very fair question. And I think that's one of the reasons why research in ECMO is very challenging, because you do have this evolving technology. It is true that ECMO today isn't going to be the same as, you know, the technology in 10, 15 years. I mean, we certainly saw a massive change in technology just since the 70s. And, you know, the initial trials for ECMO in, you know, severe refractory ARDS, they were negative trials with really poor outcomes. And I think it is fair to say that potentially, based on these data and maybe the REST trial and other ECOR data, you know, the physiologic effects and benefits of doing this intervention are there, it seems like, from those data, from our experience, but potentially it's too risky of a procedure to sort of merit using this intervention in those populations. And so to me, the biggest takeaway of all is to really understand where these complications and where these adverse events are coming from and how can we minimize them? How can we improve the technology, improve our operator skill, improve our anticoagulation techniques and these kinds of questions to really improve the safety of these devices and make narrow or widen that risk benefit margin.
Yeah, I agree. I think definitely there's still ongoing interest in this question and for this population of patients. And again, I think like maybe one of the more direct line things to take from this trial is, again, like maybe we weren't so good at determining who the sick failure of NIV patients were, because again, not many patients here ended up being intubated. But at least there was a signal that maybe in those that they were sick and they did get intubated, that using ECOR in that population to sort of accelerate liberation and maybe some other outcomes could be important. So again, a future trial might focus again on patients who have failed as a strategy. But I think I agree with Whitney. I think, you know, the technology is constantly evolving. Our understanding of, you know, the physiology, how it interacts with sick patients is also evolving. And if we could better identify patients at highest risk, so the benefit could be the greatest, and then we develop advances in the technology and our management strategies, anticoagulation and these sorts of things that make the technology safer, then again, we might actually shift the balance towards more benefit, more net benefits than net harms. And so I think there will be ongoing interest in the intervention for this group of patients. And again, maybe just to highlight finally that this trial did use this one device. There are a few other devices either on the market or coming to market that might have a different risk profile. So again, that could be open question that could be examined in a future study. And you may or may not be aware that actually now based on REST and now this trial, that this actually device is being removed from the market at the end of the year.
Oh, no, I wasn't aware of that.
This is where I'll ask a question that usually Whitney will roll her eyes and the rest of my ECMO group will go, why is Todd so naive? But if we're talking about smaller sized cannulas or catheters, we're talking about lower flows and we've talked a little bit about, you know, maybe it's a little bit closer to dialysis than full ECMO. Are there opportunities for things like citrate anticoagulation instead of heparin anticoagulation, which we use a lot of citrate in our practice with our continuous renal replacement therapy, that might alter the risks that we're seeing, decrease the risks that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think, again, these are all the kinds of advances that are being studied. Again, there is a non-FDA approved device that operates as a add-on to a current CRRT platform that basically removes CO2 that would use regional anticoagulation. So again, that's a possibility. Now, again, the challenge, of course, is that at some point, as you make these devices smaller and the flow lower, the efficiency of CO2 removal might decrease. So again, depending on what there'll be some trade-offs there. So, and that's why, I guess, in the end, we need a clinical trial to test, you know, the efficacy of these devices and whether they'll remove enough CO2 to affect a clinical benefit in these patients. But yes, like regional anticoagulation, different surfaces that might require less systemic anticoagulation, different kinds of anticoagulants, maybe direct thrombin inhibitors like bivalirudin or argatroban or different, you know, sort of maybe antiplatelet agents. Like there's a whole, back to one of the original questions, all these unanswered questions about what the optimal strategy could be that will actually lead to less risks and maybe again, push the balance to net benefits.
So it sounds like we'll come back to this question at some point in the future. I think you guys went over kind of all I had left, just kind of talking about what the next steps and future directions are. Whitney, Eddie, do you guys have anything else that you want to talk about as far as ECMO, ECOR, or this trial in general, or where we are?
I find it interesting, Eddie, that you didn't accuse them of reading your outline.
Well, I mean, you're the one who led them to that question. And so I was just going to spare you from another accusation of reading my outline. Got it.
One of the things I wonder about, just really for my own learning, is thinking about this trial in terms of study design and how we can, you know, optimize study design. It's something I've really, you know, learned from really all of you and my other research mentors, is that, you know, in order to do clinical trials, it's so simple, but you have to be able to enroll and you have to be able to show some separation between groups. And some of that can be very challenging in ECMO. I'm wondering kind of what you all think about if this is a question that can be answered. I think I get very excited and I want to answer a lot of questions and I'm interested in a lot of things around ECMO. But I think when you think about clinical trials and the investment and the time and the energy that you spend doing these trials, it's really important that you're asking the right questions and questions that can be answered feasibly. And so I guess one of the questions I have is this a question that we can answer using a large clinical trial? And what in particular might jump out at you that could be improved for this particular study design?
I will say this, that as we've been just talking here, this thought has popped into my mind, which sort of makes me laugh a little bit. But Eddie talked about there are case series and some observational data before this randomized trial that said, you know, hey, look, this might work. And it prevented these patients from being intubated. And then we did the trial and it turns out that the patients didn't get intubated anyway. And so I think some of the importance of doing clinical trials is understanding, you know, those biases and that sort of thing. I think your point is well taken. You have to have enough of the right patients to study in order to do a trial to get the right outcome. And that's what makes some of this stuff hard. But maybe I'm an optimist now. Maybe you've rubbed off on me, Whitney. I don't know.
It's only taken 5 years.
Right. Nice. But I still feel like there's a population we just have to identify that ECOR actually will have benefits in, and those benefits will outweigh the risks. And I think some of that will be learning the risks and learning how to minimize the risks and reduce those. But I also think, you know, we need to try and identify and enrich the population to truly figure out who this is, who we should be doing this in.
Yeah. Something that we've kind of been dancing around is something we've referenced on the podcast before, is that we as clinicians are pretty bad at predicting when patients need something. So this is like the takeaway from the early versus late trials, TrachMan. This is the takeaway from the early versus late dialysis, that if you randomize someone to late dialysis or late trach, that 30% of them don't end up getting dialysis or getting a trach. And so I think you're seeing that here, right? That here, almost nobody, we said, oh, these are the patients who need to be intubated, and they didn't end up getting intubated. And so I think that was one of the things in the kind of the patient selection here. It just kind of follows a theme of critical care literature that I noticed.
And I will say, Eddie, some of us are worse at predicting than others.
Yeah, I know. We don't have to name names here, Todd.
Right. Correct.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great discussion. But that's all we have for this episode of the ICU Ed and Toddcast. If you have any questions for Todd or myself or Whitney or Eddie or anything you want us to talk about in the future, you can hit us up at the icuedandtoddcast@gmail.com. You can hit us up on the social at icucast at Ed Chan. That's EDQIN at Todd Rice_ICU.
Whitney_Gannon.
Mine is EFAN75.
Thank you, Eddie, Whitney, for taking the time. Thank you, Todd. Thank you, and congratulations to all authors. Thank you to Mike Gannon for the intro and outro music. Thank you again to everyone listening, and we will see you next time. Let's go save some lives.
Let's go redefine.
This podcast is made for educational purposes. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. It's inevitable, but we try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represent our own and not of any entity that we work at. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.